So I'm not sure that today's teachings will have a particularly coherent beginning and middle and end in the way that talks can have. But rather I'd like to offer some reflections really about waking up, partly in the context of this title, because it ought to be included. Transforming our lives in the midst of what is. Many of you have spent time, some short time, some longer time, many, many times maybe, in silent meditation retreats of some days or some weeks or some months. Silent meditation retreats being kind of the powerhouse of this kind of tradition. The refinement of mind that's possible in sustained silence. The way the body can really relax and lighten. And the way our whole being really can be very well studied. A silent meditation retreat is like putting our being under the microscope. When we put aside a lot of the other activities and of life and make things as simple as possible. And for those of you who've been on retreats, there's a lot of wonderful resources in silent meditation retreat. The resources of the silence, of the schedule, of practice, in a similar way that we've been doing a kind of mini version of today. The resources of support and teachings and a great deal of skill that's brought to supporting people in that. And then, at the end of the retreat, the advice is often given to go forth and be mindful. And I've sometimes been struck by how much detail and skill and support is offered during a meditation retreat for the process of meditation, and then one line to cover the whole of the rest of life. Go forth and be mindful. It doesn't seem quite enough, unless we're going to spend our whole lives in meditation retreat. Which clearly, if you're living in London, you're not. And so the reflections I wanted to explore today are this sense of transforming our lives in the midst of what is. Our what is, meaning the context of modern, urban, lay life. And of course, running through the thread of all of our lives, this sense of go forth and be mindful, is at the heart of the matter. It's been at the heart of the matter in our exploration today. And without cultivating some calm, some steadiness, some brightness in the mind, it's very, very hard to really see clearly. And the kind of classical image from the contemplative traditions is often one of a pool of water representing our mind that is constantly getting stirred up by our emotional life, by our reactivity, by the things we pursue, by the things we resist, etc. If we want to understand the nature of this mind, we need to see deeply into it. It's very hard to see deeply into a body of water if it's constantly getting stirred up. And so concentration practice, samadhi, this we're really training the mind to be able to be steady, to stop stirring things up, and to cultivate the capacity to actually bear witness to actually get curious about and to extend a profound care, gentleness, a holding, an allowing capacity to our inner lives. And what else? What else can support the transformation of our life? The revolution in the heart that's mentioned here is one little bit the same as I've been saying this morning. It's really a revolution, in the way the Buddha described, of avoiding extremes. That means the usual extremes we're involved in our experience are of pursuit or avoidance, reaching out for or resisting. And the more we see that, the more we may be shocked, shocked by how limited that is. How limited a way to meet life. By trying to pursue what we want and get rid of what we don't want, and the agitation that's absolutely implicit in both ways. So, the revolution in the heart is to find another way of connecting our heart, of meeting, of allowing experience, that is primarily interested in the fact that things are happening, rather than what should be happening or what shouldn't be happening. Is that clear? Do I need to give examples? Okay, good. And having spent the last couple of days in London, I've been struck by how many good opportunities there are for that. London is one of the most supportive environments I've ever been in for solitude. When I go to a shop in the village where I live in France, there's no noble silence. In the shop, I have to say, hello, how are you, how are you doing, how are the family, some few back and forth about the weather, and something about the time of year and the various things that are being planted or harvested. Only then can I buy the loaf of bread I went in for and leave. But in London, everyone observes noble silence. They only see the minimum of what's it? £1.30. That's it. Thank you very much. You're gone. And the same on the train and the tube. Nobody speaks to me. They all deeply respectfully leave me in my solitude. Quite extraordinary. And I notice actually quite seriously that I get more solitude, more quiet time with myself moving around in London for a few days than in almost any other part of my life, except for if I'm in some kind of solitary retreat situation. So I'm envious of all of you. There's sometimes a bit of a weird vibe, I have to say, on the tube. Was I speaking this morning about this purposefulness? Was that? No. And so one sometimes feels the kind of drivenness of people's lives somehow. And one can feel that solitude that people accord me very kindly isn't necessarily a particularly respectful according of solitude, but more like some kind of pathological fear of contacting any other human being. But nevertheless, one is accorded a lot of solitude. That means one is accorded just through the simple things of going about one's life and travelling around the city here, a lot of opportunity to abide with oneself. Tendency is, rather than abiding with oneself, to be locked into pursuit or avoidance. No? Obsessing around where I'm going, or what I need to get, or what I need to do, or what I need to have, and how I'm going to do, have, get it. That's called the world of pursuit. Or the world of avoidance. Everything that's wrong, what shouldn't be happening, how I can get rid of it, how I can stop it from happening in the future, whose fault it is that it's like this, what I'm going to do to them, or about that, or whatever. So there's lots of different words we could use to describe those two movements, but that's what we, if we look honestly, we find we often spend our time investing in. A revolution in the heart asks ourselves, is that skillful? Do I want to perpetuate pursuit and avoidance? And to recognize the opportunity for abiding with oneself. For those who've done lots of meditation retreats, we can find this rather unfortunate position wherein Dharma practice gets equated with the silent retreat environment, and the rest of life is a gradual watering down of one's practice until it gets so dismal that we go on retreat again. As I say, I don't wish in any way to give the impression that I'm not in favour of silent meditation retreats and that's that kind of powerhouse effect, but it has to be that the refinement of mind that's possible in meditation retreat isn't possible in the rest of life when we are engaged with a lot of duties and responsibilities. But that doesn't mean that the possibility for practicing Dharma, for engaging with life, for meeting with what's happening are different. There's a very nice story of a Tibetan teacher that was taken to Hong Kong to do some teaching, or Singapore, I can't remember. But when he arrived, they took him up in this very tall hotel, tall tower block, to the hotel. And apparently, looking around, he said, oh, look at the mass of cars and tall buildings and the intensity of any kind of busy city environment. And he shook his head. He said, very bad place for meditation practice. And then he said, very good place for Dharma practice. So the kind of conditions one has in a busy life aren't particularly the kind of conditions that support refinement of consciousness in terms of depth of meditation. Of course they're not. That's why, if you want to do a week's long silent retreat, Gaia House offers them in Devon rather than in Piccadilly Circus. It's much more suitable. And yet it would be a shame if we equated the possibility for practicing Dharma, the possibility for knowing a free relationship with life, just with that kind of refinement. If we equated it basically with peaceful conditions. We could have, and some spiritual teachings really are orientated around trying to make the mind peaceful. And to a certain extent, peaceful conditions will support that. No? If we spend a long time in silence, not having lots of agitating stimulations, peaceful external conditions contribute greatly to peaceful internal conditions. But however much we arrange the external conditions, there's no guarantee that we can make the mind peaceful and make it stay that way. If there was a formula for making the mind peaceful, somebody would have patented it by now and be selling it to us. Step 1, step 2, step 3, peaceful mind. There probably is a book like that, actually, but I wouldn't buy it. So we could, and people do, make a practice out of trying to make the mind peaceful. But I would have much more faith, not in trying to make the mind into any kind of condition, because it's so unreliable. If there's one thing we can really notice about our mind, it's that they change a lot, and that we can't set up any guaranteed conditions. So rather than trying to make the mind peaceful, our opportunity is to actually be peaceful with however the mind is. And that's really a rather different approach. And that's the approach that is supported by all the people in the tube in allowing us this opportunity to abide with ourselves. And despite the humour in it, I think it's actually a serious point. I'm sure all of you spend time moving across London in the various delights of London transport. And there's so much opportunity in there to feel into oneself, to feel into what's happening, to be peaceful with the way the mind is, however it is. Means to actually be willing to tolerate ourselves, to tolerate the condition of our minds or our hearts. To tolerate the distracted mind. To tolerate the miserable mind. To tolerate the judgmental mind. Firstly, because to tolerate means to come into relationship with, to be close to allow, is to check out of, it's to switch the focus of our attention. If we're not what I'm calling tolerating, allowing, abiding with the miserable mind, then we tend to be living out of it, sitting in the tube in an unconscious way. We may be semi-conscious, we may know, oh yes, I'm miserable, but we don't know what that is. We just know the story about it. I'm miserable because this happened and that happened and this didn't happen and that didn't happen and this should have happened and that shouldn't have happened. And the tendency, when we buy into the mind state like that, the tendency is to believe that our well-being in this moment is inaccessible because of those things that happened or didn't happen. You see what I mean? If we're invested in, identified with, lost in any mind state, at the moment I'm saying miserable mind state, then we're living out the story of it. Oh yes, and then I should have... And automatically, if we're invested in that way, our belief is that those things that happened are the things that have cut me off from well-being. Or those things that didn't happen, or whatever. The real revolution in the heart is seeing that our well-being is not to do with the content of our mind. It's not to do with the story of what created this mind state, but has got much, much more to do with our relationship with it. What a revolution! To meet the miserable mind, not in terms of the reasons I'm miserable and how I got there and what I might be able to do to change it to something else, but to actually abide with it, to feel the way it is. What is a miserable mind state? Where do I feel it in my body? How does it express? What kind of bodily posture do I take in miserableness? To actually contact oneself in the process of miserableness, because they're a verb, all these things. We say, I'm miserable, as if that's something fixed. I am miserable. That's who I am. I'm miserable. But actually what we're doing is we're miserabling. We're perpetuating the sense of continuity, called I am miserable, through these endless thoughts that feed it. Can we, sitting on the tube or anything else, actually contact the way we're keeping that going? Just to be in contact with it has an extraordinary sense of intimacy, and can, as that deepens, contact a sense of wonder, of gratitude even, for being able to be in contact with life. And that is accessible to us to the extent that it doesn't matter what the flavour is of the thing we're in contact with. Does that? You following? It actually doesn't matter in this possibility for abiding with what's happening, whether we're abiding with miserable state of mind or contented state of mind, happy state of mind or sad state of mind. I prefer happy state of mind. I prefer, whatever, the ones we all prefer. But richer than my personal preferences, more satisfying than the things I'd like to experience or not, infinitely more satisfying, is the feeling of being close to the truth of life. And if misery is the truth of life in this moment, I'll take that over the wishing it wasn't so and comparing it to a happiness that isn't here right now. So my encouragement, I guess, really based on my own reflections over the last few days of being in London. I've been here since Wednesday, I think, apart from going to Oxford yesterday. And just doing those things, going around on the tube, etc. is to actually use this resource of solitude. The resource of the capacity to abide with ourselves in whatever circumstances we find it, and to use it as a way of daring to connect with what is, instead of reacting to what should be or could be. So that our sense of a lay, urban, modern practice isn't a watered down version of retreat practice, but is a living, vibrant sense of discovery in its own right that has a different flavour to it than retreat practice. But that it doesn't need to even be measured in terms of better or worse, more or less dharmic. The other, another big area, I think, of lay modern yogic life is in the world of our closest relationships. And our families or our lovers or the people that we live most closely with, or the people, even if we live alone, the people that we have the most close contact with, are our monastery in some way. We have the idea sometimes, but for monastics, you know, they don't have to face all these kind of issues. They're just off to the monastery, as if off to the monastery implies that everything gets simpler. And certainly that message is there very much in the Buddhist texts. There's a place where the householder says, and they have these stock phrases, if you've read the Buddhist texts, they have lots of stock phrases. So one of the stock phrases is, confined and dusty is the life of the householder. Open and free is the life of the homeless one. Why should I not then shave off my long hair and cast off my fine robes and put on rags and go forth in the dispensation of the Holy One? And it says, and so saying, the householder so-and-so did cut off his hair, shave off his robes, and flow off with the Buddha, happily ever after. So, happily ever after means it's a fairy tale. If you, I don't know if people have been to Amaravati from here, Theravada Monastery, north of London. Oh, they've got plenty of confined and dusty going on there. And this was, after I spent 4 or 5 years in Asia in much more kind of solitary, contemplative life, and then in a rather unplanned way found that I was going to have a daughter, not quite me have, but with my partner. Then, you know, the context of my life changed very much from this kind of solitary yogic life to family life. And some mornings I would chant almost to myself, confined and dusty is the life of the household. Aware that there was irony in it, and yet that sense that we can have that my life is somehow so complicated, my life is so full of stuff or difficulties or complexities, or my particular configuration doesn't lend itself to Dharma practice. If my partner was more supportive, or if my parents hadn't confused me so much, or if my job was less stressful, or if my, you see what I mean? Now you can fill in your own little blanks. If only my life was better in this or that other respect, then I'd really be able to do the Dharma thing. The container of our life is our monastery, in that sense. And I think it's really helpful to use it as such. The things that go on with the people we're closest to are really revealing for us. We tend to notice how revealing they are about the other people. And it may be that we have some difficulties in our family relationships, or our love relationships, or our working relationships, or whatever other relationships are very close for us. But actually, the one of the most skillful things we can do is remove ourselves a bit from those relationships, to try for what we could call maximum sincerity with minimum contact. But at the same time, and so that might be, depending on people's circumstances, that might be the wise response. But at the same time, what is it exactly? I think this is a koan. What is it exactly that's so difficult to be with? That we would like to say, well, it's because he does this and she does that, and what is it that actually is so difficult to be with? And when we're asking that question, it's not about finding the answer, oh, it's for this or it's for that. It's asking the question in a way that's not interested in answering it. It's asking the question in a way that's interested in leading us into our inner experience. Being actually feeling the way our buttons get pressed. Because it's very revealing. If our button's being pressed, there's something unfree in there. If there's something unfree in there, that's the gateway. The revolution in the heart is to actually take on board the place of difficulty as the place of access to freedom from difficulty. And the Buddha said in one of his most famous lines, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. And he said this again and again, I teach one thing and one, he didn't just say, oh, I just teach suffering and the end of suffering. He emphasized, this is one thing and one thing only. And then if we start to count, one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. It sounds like two. But the Buddha emphasized, this is one thing and one thing only. If we really contact, if we really understand, what is it that's suffering? What is it that's tight? What is it that seems to be in the way of me and a free relationship with life? To really see that is also to see the resolution of it. But that seeing doesn't always happen just like that. Sometimes it does. Sometimes there's a seeing of some particular issue in our life, and we see what's been happening so clearly that we're able to know with the genuine conviction, I've seen through that. That thing that's been having this grip on my life, that's been getting me into a knot or into a mess for so long, I've really seen through it. And one knows it just can't get a grip anymore. And that's the experience the Buddha had with the whole edifice of self-belief. And there's this kind of dramatic moment when the Buddha wakes up under the tree in Bodh Gaya and says, house builder, I've seen you. Your ridge pole is broken and your roof is tumbled down. You will build this house no more. It's a very kind of almost melodramatic. But that sense of what we can feel in that and what we can know in our own experience sometimes is the unshakable knowing that something's been seen through so well that it can't get a grip on the mind again. And sometimes it's not seen through that well. Often what happens is that we see in glimpses, you know, we see in bits, we see that there's something going on here that isn't all about what he's doing and what she's doing or whatever. There's something going on here that I see I'm somehow responsible for my own getting in a mess with this situation. We might say, oh, he made me angry. But one knows that one's actually responsible. However, the other person may have been acting in a way that was unkind and hurtful. But if our own response gets us hot, gets us tight, gets us feeling unfree, we sense our own responsibility in that. So we might start to see the way in which something's going on in me that's causing me pain, that's causing me difficulty, that's causing me issues. But that we might see then more deeply than that and know exactly what it is. Oh, it's my tendency to believe such and such a thing, whatever it might be. I'll try to think of an example. I don't know. But we can hopefully find examples in our own lives. If it's not clear and you'd like me to... I don't want to be abstract here. So if you'd like to, if you need an example for any of these things, if as I'm speaking something seems confusing or just plain wrong or not clear, please raise your hand. I'd much rather give some clarification, if I can, than for you to... for it to be misunderstood or not understood. So we have some sense of, I know what's going on in my life, but I don't seem to be able to see it clearly enough to stop it happening. And sometimes people will even will complain, will say, well, I've seen it. Dharma practice, this emphasis on seeing into. I'm aware of it, I'm being with it, but it's still happening. If it's still happening, whatever the it is, whatever the knot of contraction, of compulsion, of fear, whatever, if it's still happening, there's something we haven't seen about it. There's something we're still invested in. There's some kind of belief that it'll make me happy. Yeah. Yeah, it could be. When I say making me happy, it could be making me right, it could be making me safe, it could be... there's lots of different shades of that. But there's some way we're invested into it in thinking that it's in our own interest. And so anger is a classic example of that, as a defense mechanism. Rather than experience, often people feel angry. It's all about you. And the belief, the justification is that if I keep that together, I can somehow avoid feeling insecure or vulnerable or unsure, or because I've got something clear to hang my sense of identity on. It's you did this to me and that's wrong. And very, very often, very, very often, when people step back from that kind of reactive energy in anger and start to actually feel into the way anger burns, so that's like I was saying at the beginning, rather than acting out or living under the influence of the anger, to actually meet it and allow it, very often underneath anger is sadness. And yet sadness is a bit more tender and vulnerable. And so part of what keeps the anger going is the belief that it'll keep me safe or it keeps me right. So this seeing, which is the meaning of vipassana, vipassana is a Pali word, so I think... Is it called London Insight Retreats here? So insight is the translation from vipassana in the Pali. Vipassana means to see into. Sometimes the seeing into is so powerful that it explodes the problem. Explodes. Yeah, kind of explodes. Dissolves. The problem just can't sustain under the impact of really being seen into. Because if we really see what's causing us tension, difficulty, dukkha, pain, the letting go of that pain is a natural, automatic response of the being. If we really see that we're doing something that hurts us, we don't need a big process about what to do about that. We naturally stop. If we're carrying a big, heavy load, we've been carrying it for so long we don't even know that it's there anymore. We're carrying. All the while we haven't seen what we're doing, we just carry on. But as soon as the seeing is there, oh, I'm carrying this heavy load I don't need to carry. Naturally, we put it down. But sometimes the seeing is partial, in the examples I just gave. So we kind of sense into the fact that there's a burden that we're carrying, that it hurts, but we haven't seen that there's nothing useful in there. We've seen that we're carrying and that there's a kind of weight and a pain attached to it, but there's some investment in. Maybe this is good stuff. We haven't seen it, it's just rocks.
I thought that was very clear actually, and I'm probably not alone in feeling the same, your description of people who say, I've seen it, and it's still there. And so my question relates really to that, but this process of seeing or scrutiny or, I mean, I don't quite understand what is, if you think you've seen it, but obviously you haven't, as far as you're talking, then what do you do next?
Keep looking. Basically, I think the important piece, I'll come in just a minute. There may be examples in our life, like this rather powerful one I just gave of the Buddha's, no? Where that seeing is complete enough that it really dissolves the problem. But in lesser examples of seeing, the tendency could be to feel disillusioned with the practice, well, I've seen it, but it's still there. But that's not complete seeing somehow. If something is still got the capacity to get us, to catch us, there's something about it we haven't seen. There's some charge that it still carries. There's something left over from the past, from what set up that thing, that hasn't been digested. And the process of digesting it, metabolizing it, if you like, is one of allowing it in. And what's difficult in our experience, and it's the difficult things that get a grip on us, we don't want to let them in. We find it much more convenient or seemingly safe to live in the world of their justifications. What I mean by that is, there's something that's impacted, something that's happened in the past to me, and it's had some painful impact. And so my relationship with that now is of fear or hurt or pain or resentment or anger or whatever. And all of those things are difficult to feel. We don't like to feel them. They have a kind of shaky quality. They have a heat. They have a knottiness that we experience in our body when we experience resentment, hurt, etc. Because they're uncomfortable to feel, the tendency is to justify them. Because we're not feeling in the justifying. We're saying, well, he did this and he did that. And so the kind of counteracting tendency to that is to, rather than getting lost in the tentacles of explaining it to ourselves or to others, is to dare to let it in and see, what is this? And then we find, oh, it's hurt. How does that show itself in the body? Oh. What am I doing with this hurt? And we start to see the way in which we're keeping it going. And there's various different mechanisms we have for keeping it going. But the heart of the matter is always that there's something we haven't seen that's actually keeping the momentum of it going. If we really see what it is that's causing us pain, that very seeing dissolves the momentum, I could say. The momentum of dukkha, the momentum of pain, the momentum of tension cannot sustain in the face of really seeing how we're keeping that going. Because that's what we always see, is that I'm keeping that going. But it's not due to what someone said or what someone did or what this situation was. If it was really due to that, there'd be no changing it. Because we can't change what someone said, we can't change what someone did. There'd be no free condition of life if what happened in the past really had the capacity to set up hurt forevermore. Just a moment. Did you still want to?
Yes, just in the same line as this part of the discussion, what I've noticed for myself is when I've located something that's cycling around like that, and I've half seen it, and it still comes forth. For me, there's usually a subtle rejection in my seeing. So I'm actually in a subtle kind of reactivity, and I'm actually trying to have it be different than what it is. So I'm not really seeing with the heart or embracing it. I'm subtly trying to get rid of it.
Right.
And as long as I'm doing that, it continues on and on and on. And it also blocks, for me, the capacity to do as you're describing and simply make contact with and feel what is actually there.
Right. Beautiful.
It's all kind of above it, trying to push it away.
Yeah. Did you hear at the back what was said? So I'll respond a little bit in a way. You wanted to say something else?
I was just going to follow up on just the discussion tonight, and I was just wondering, is this sometimes that the only life experience, I mean the combination of going into the feeling, but also new life experiences, will help you to really be able to understand what's going on better? Because sometimes it feels like another life experience makes us really go into so much pain that we have the ability then to go deeper into the experience and understand it better. And just the meditating, maybe sometimes we've gone as far as we can go. We need something coming from externally towards us to help us to go deeper.
To a certain extent, I mean, I think what you're calling new life experiences means, you know, we grow and learn as we move along. But having some new life experience doesn't necessarily dissolve the old stuff. That which is unmetabolized, this seems to be, as far as I can tell, like one of these fundamental laws of the So the point that was made here, which I think is a really important one, is that very often what we call being aware of or seeing into has some subtle strategizing in it. The best example for this is with good old leg pain, I think. We say, oh, my leg is hitting, leg pain, I'll just observe it, I'll just be aware of it. Oh, it's still here. So what we mean by I'll just be aware of it is I'll be aware of it so that it'll go away. So that it'll stop bothering me. No, no, no. That's not called being intimate with, contacting, allowing, embracing. It's called laying out it's basically aversion, what the person called subtle aversion. And that, this morning I mentioned a few times, it's undemanding presence. Or what we referred to this afternoon as non-pursuing, non-resisting. It's that real accommodating of experience that doesn't need it to, doesn't want it to go away, that's willing to allow it. And that real willingness to allow is what opens up. And that opening up can be so vast that the whole of life finds its rest in it. And that is another one of these laws of the universe while we're on them, that whatever we give space to, it opens up. Whatever we give space to, it opens up. But it has to be genuine space. It can't be space with an agenda. I'll give you space as long as you... So, a few people are raising their hands. I'm just aware of the way the time is going. So what I would propose is that I just finish a little bit these reflections, and we take a break of a few minutes to stretch our legs, and then we can have a time that's more general for questions and exploring in that way for a short time. And we kind of went here and there a little bit. But my intention really, as I say, was rather than to give some formulaic beginning and middle and end thing, to wave the flag for the genuine and authentic possibilities of practicing and understanding and freeing our life in the midst of its context, and to challenge a little bit the idea that our so-called daily life is a watered-down version of where the real juice is, where the real practice gets done in silent retreat. One of the great beauties of this kind of tradition is the emphasis it's put on deep meditation practice. But one of the limitations of that emphasis is the subtle orthodoxy that gets built up, that depth and silence go together. That silence is where depth happens, and that depth happens in silence. And actually, we may notice this ourselves, very, very often we find that our deepest experiences aren't necessarily in meditation. We certainly find that the real polishing of our deepest experiences are never in meditation. There might be some access to this refinement that I spoke about at the beginning. But real insight is that which makes a difference, that which transforms. And therefore real insight gets, the real transformation of our being happens, not because of some beautiful or some deep experience, but because of actually orientating our understanding around that experience. Or better, living in the light of that experience. If we see the flux of life, the endless movement of life, the impermanence of life, it's very nice to have some beautiful meditative moment where you wake up and say, oh, I see everything's changing. And people report seeing this really spectacularly, beautifully, even to actually have such a subtlety of attention that we can see at the cellular level of our own being, we note it, we can be directly in touch with that kind of unshakable knowing of impermanence. But that experience will just come and will just go, and a few days later or a few weeks later it'll be supremely irrelevant. Just like every other experience we ever had. And so our practice is really not about having those beautiful experiences, but about living in the light of their understanding. If we see the truth, if we intuit even the truth of change, our responsibility as yogis is to live our life in the light of knowing things change, to examine our reactions when things change, to be in our intimate relationships aware of change, to make our choices and decisions about what we engage in life in the light of change. And so that silent meditation is something profoundly beautiful. The wish to be in silence, the abiding in silence, the refinement that's possible in silence, deeply beautiful, but that it's not held apart from the rest of life. But the resource of silence and intensive meditation can really support our practice. But there are, our practice can be really alive and vibrant in the whole of our life. In the way that this Tibetan teacher says, oh, busy city. Not so supportive for meditation practice. Very supportive of Dharma practice. Confronted again and again by opportunities to see where our buttons get pushed. And in some kind of quite mysterious paradox, in a city where there's 20 million people every day, confronted by so many opportunities to abide with ourselves, to abide with what's happening for us. And in that abiding, to be so close to life that we can taste its freedom. May it be so for each one of us and for all beings. Okay. So let's just take 4 or 5 minutes for some short walking or to use the bathroom or to stretch one's legs, and then we'll finish together in here.